Welcome to the Month End, a CPG community chat. The Month End will provide emerging CPG brands real-life knowledge into the accounting, finance, and operational worlds. Our guests will be key stakeholders from those same brands, as well as other key contributors to the industry, all of which have vast experiences and insights that will be shared with the audience. Welcome to the Month End podcast, episode 18 with Steve Lutman. How are you doing today, Steve?
Doing good, Brad. How are you?
Doing well. So, Steve and Accountfully, I guess, has a kind of a long-standing relationship where we've supported some of your kind of overall brands that you're associated with. So at a high level at this point, and I'm going to have you kind of detail out your background, but you're managing director of Tortoise and Bolt Marketing and Ventures. And then through that entity, we've connected on several kind of brands, right? Drink brands, most recently Hercules Mulligan, Flaviar exclusive ready to drink Old Fashioned, which is great. Bondbreaker, the world's first Hefeweizen whiskey in Texas. And then the last company we're working with at this point is American Liquor Co., the first and only four crop vodka. So exciting times. Clearly you don't like to drink or deal with alcohol.
Right.
So excited to chat on the Month End podcast. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Yeah, good to be here. Yeah, thank you, Brad, for inviting me.
For sure. So why don't we get started kind of on your history? So clearly you've been involved in the CPG kind of the brand space for a long time. Yeah. So can you kind of just tell us where you started from and kind of your life cycle from corporate world to doing your own thing to now Tortoise and Bolt and kind of just walk us through all that.
Sure. I grew up at Unilever in the food and beverage world. So I started in Europe as a trainee for Unilever in Austria, and then I worked full-time with them in the United States and New York and the region. And, I worked on the pasta sauce wars and Ben and Jerry's and Lipton iced tea. And, I was there for 10 years. Also took me to Brazil, where I was there for 3 years as a marketeer. And then I moved after 10 years at Unilever to Diageo Moët Hennessy, LVMH. Used to have a Shefflin Somerset, a joint venture for luxury spirit brands. And worked with them for a few years in marketing. And then I realized, I created a few brands or was involved with creating a few brands with them. And I realized I could probably do this myself and was eager to kind of get out on my own and created the Blonde LeBlanc Cachaça from Brazil, built a craft distillery with some partners down in the middle of nowhere in Brazil and launched LeBlanc in 40 countries, did that for 12 years, and that was acquired by Bacardi in 2017. And then since 2017, Tortoise and Bolt, it's basically a way of me finding opportunities and creating new ventures. And the three brands that I'm working on now, Hercules Mulligan, Bondbreaker, and American Vodka, are just all unique individual, propositions and opportunities that are, very, very attractive to me. And each one of them has their own challenges and unique sales propositions. And, I'd say they do have one thing in common is we're working with you on all of them, which is fantastic because it allows us to scale. And it gives me one common process to work across all three that we can learn from one, what works better on the other, and just have a common practice across all three brands.
Yes. And we definitely enjoy you as clients across those three entities. So kind of as we go back, what was the major, in your background is marketing, correct?
Yeah. I'm a marketeer that dabbles in everything,
Yeah. Gotcha. So from back in the day in the corporate space, then moving on to your own brand, LeBlanc, what was the biggest transition from the corporate world to small business entrepreneur doing it yourself? Because I'm sure there was 15 different, I have to do this, I have to do that. But what was like the biggest shock factor or change, or maybe it's a couple?
Sure. Fundraising. I mean, you realize capital, when you work in the corporate world in the big entities, yes, you have to raise money internally. But when you're in the incubator space, when you're in the early stage of a brand, you're living hand to mouth most of the time for the first year or two, and you have to go raise the money or use your own and bootstrap everything. You don't have an R&D department, you don't have an accounting department, you don't have anything. You're doing everything. You're faxing and you're selling and you're raising. So, but raising money, I think, is the is really the sea change, and it makes you grow up real quick.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. So, from your and interesting. I mean, if I'm looking here, 2005, you created this brand. It's now 2022. Mm-hmm. Technology is completely changing everything, right?
But everything.
You know, back in that space when you had to raise money in the 2005 to 2010 range, right? What what was a couple of kind of pointers, I guess, to an entrepreneur of things to think about? But then also, now that you're on the other side of the table now, possibly, right? Looking at brands and finding partners who are bootstrapped, like, I guess, tell me kind of the different mindsets of them from where you were and now where you're at, and kind of benefits or positive recommendations or just kind of information that you get for the emerging brand owners.
Yeah, you know, when you're starting out, you don't know what you don't know, and trying to fill that gap with people that know is really important. And getting that Rolodex and getting advisors and getting people that can shortcut you in terms of getting knowledge and capability and information is really important. The thing that's really different today is what I call the gig economy. Back then, there wasn't this robust gig economy. So, you know, you wouldn't even think of 1099ing people. You know, it was not even, you know, it was weird. You know, can you work part-time or can you work, you know, plan A is the gig economy. Plan B is full-time. You don't have to, and you know, you think about the talent you can get at all levels, at the high levels, you can get, you know, world-class talent in the gig economy that you wouldn't want to raise full-time, you know, hire full-time. So that's the biggest change of all.
It's so true. The fractional world versus the full-time world, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. And the pandemic just accelerated. I mean, everyone, you know, I think we were moving in that direction, but the pandemic taught a lot of people that, you know, you can work from home or you don't have to work in an office or you can be virtual. And I think it just accelerated the gig economy, you know, the 1099 thing.
Definitely. We have a, I don't know, handful of clients that are international. Is there any weird, like, you know, from you being in Brazil with your brand, like, is there like any different, and again, this could change then today, but just, is there anything different in terms of how like Brazil operated versus the US, or are there any nuances if there is brands out there that, you know, are international or some US or some, you know, international, some domestic?
Yeah, I it's a different culture. I mean, it really is. It's a relationship culture, which is very endearing. It's fun. I mean, you get to really know the people you work with. People take the relationship there much more seriously. It is more inefficient in that regard. I mean, there is that factor. There is also, you know, there's the payola issue that you have to deal with in certain circumstances, which, you know, you do have to do here, but it's all above board there. There's a lot that's below board that you know, as a gringo, you don't even know how to deal with it. You know, like, what are you asking me? You don't even know, you know, and certainly the language, you know, I mean, you know, you always assume everyone works in English, but they don't. No, I mean, in Brazil, for specifically, you have to work in Portuguese.
I think it's a different culture, different lifestyle.
Totally. And there's always a weird thing, you know, like, for example, on Leblon, we age our cachaça in, you know, XO cognac cask from France. And so, you know, we brought in a 40-foot container of XO cognac casks from Cognac, France. And it got to the port. And what we didn't know is that you can't import used manufacturing equipment into Brazil. It's illegal. It has to be, you have to buy new. You know, they do it for their economy. So, so literally we had to send them back. You know, we did find a workaround, which is, you know, we got them back and we sanded the outside of the barrels so they look new and send them back. Say, oh, they're all new barrels. So we got them in, but there's always a weird thing like that, you know?
Yeah. Different nuances coming.
Tax regime, you know, all the taxes are, you know, it's different. Yeah. You know, not that it's more complex than here. It is complex there, but same thing. You need, need some people that can help you that know what they're doing.
Definitely, definitely. So moving on to Tortoise and Volt. So give us a little more background about, like, you know, the firm and yeah. you know, the goal of what you are. Clearly, we've identified some partnerships that we collaborate on or we work with you on, but do you work with other brands? Like, you know, what is the core service and what do you want to do with that company?
Yeah, so it's a marketing and ventures business. So, you know, it's consulting on the first and foremost, consulting for other brands. They're usually very quick in and out projects. We do, you know, concepting, we do brand identity, and then we do business strategy. That's our core service. Obviously, our footprints in CPG and beverages and bev alcohol certainly is a specialty. But I really do it to create opportunities that is on the venturing end. So that's the focus. And you know, I've been fortunate enough to have three really exciting projects come out of Tortoise and Volt where, you know, I'm either the founder or the fractional CEO. You know, on Hercules Mulligan, that started from reading a book in 2015, which, as you mentioned, I partnered with Flavier on. You know, American Vodka, I had the good fortune of meeting some great guys, the founders and creating that brand in the Midwest. And then, you know, more recently Bonbrecker with some, you know, some really great entrepreneurs based down in Texas and a country music singer named Randy Rogers. So, you know, I couldn't be more fortunate in terms of the three ventures that I'm working on.
Awesome. So then for those specific three ventures, how did those work out to where you actually, you know, became part of the core team and a founder and launching sure. brands versus actual your, you know, more of your 1099 vendor relationships, your strategic relationships with other brands where you're in and out? Like, how did that
yeah.
come to fruition?
You know, it wasn't a straight line at all. It was just happenstance. Hercules Mulligan, you know, literally developed that in 2015. And got it to a place where I was ready to launch it, but I had another project that I you know, I had to choose. I couldn't do both, so I had to find a partner with Hercules Mulligan if I wanted to keep going. And I was just grabbing a breakfast or a drink with Grisha Soba at Flaviar, and you know, just ask his advice. I didn't know they were in the space of building brands because they're a marketplace and a yep. club. And then next thing you know, we're partners, and you know, they have amazing capabilities, a great community, and they have a great marketing department and sales department. So we launched a direct to consumer during the pandemic, right before on the evacuation day, November 25th, 2019, and proved concept over 2 years. And kudos to them. I mean, they did an amazing job. Now we launched in New York. I hired the sales team and you know, an ecosystem, really bring that forward. So that one, I founded the brand and, you know, very fortunate to take direct to consumer during the pandemic, because who would have thought? Yeah. Whereas American Vodka, you know, was introduced to them through, I can't even remember how I met these guys, but, you know, they were looking for someone to lead the project. And initially I said, you guys are crazy. It's a vodka. That is very hard to do a vodka. As we all know, I mean, it's very commoditized, but, you know, one, I really like the founders and the partners, you know, just said, I can learn a lot from these guys. And this project has a high level of difficulty. And I, you know, I like the initial thought, the design, and, started working with them. And I think we cracked it with this four crop vodka blend approach. I mean, we call it the vodka whiskey lovers, totally different approach to a vodka, where most vodkas are in silos, and we found a way to you know, blend four different crops and create a different tasting vodka. And then on Bonbrecker, it really was through services. I was providing the services of naming and concepting, and then brand identity, and you know, really hit it off with these guys. And these guys are really smart entrepreneurs, not from the industry, but you know, you wouldn't know it. They're all working different aspects, different industries completely, but we hit it off. And more importantly, it's in my wheelhouse. You know, I'm a concept brand guy. You know, it's a lifestyle brand, and this one's a destination brand. I mean, it sounds funny, but it's from New Braunfels, Texas, but it's very similar to LeBlanc. where it's a destination, you know, it's the place in the bottle and it's the spirit, you know, not in terms of the liquid, but it's a, you know, the spirit of the place. So, you know, we're all three brands are now in market. You know, we're focusing Weinbrecher in Texas. We're American Vodka is in the Midwest in 6 states. And then, you know, Hercules Mulligan's, you know, national via direct to consumer through Flaviar, but now we're in New York City and killing it. I mean, the brand is, you know, I just pinch myself. You know, I have significant imposter syndrome. And when people tell me they love the brand, I'm always, and the product, I'm like, really? Are you sure? You know, and that one, they're just ecstatic about it. We got some magic in the bottle there.
Yeah. I think all three of them are very cool brand concepts. So good work on all that stuff. So moving on from, you know, this marketing, you know, venture, creating a product. So now you have a product, or now you have a brand or a concept. Now we need to go to market. Now we need to, we're a small business. We need to, you know, raise money. We need to get inventory, supply chain. So let's kind of walk through the core kind of facet of, you know, kind of this podcast, operations, you know, accounting, yeah, finance. Number one, let's just focus on operations, inventory, kind of like, you know, how do you manage your inventory on these brands? You know, just kind of walk us through that process.
Sure. So everyone's different, but typically I look for partners, you know, on the production end, and the more capable, the better. And the more capable, the greater the commitment level. So, you know, on one of my projects, one of my production partners is a co-founder. You know, he became an equity owner, skin in the game, and therefore took on all the development and the working capital, which in this business is extreme. You know, the other two projects, you know, we just found some distilleries local that had the capability, had the attitude, the mindset, and we work with them. Typically, we do all the purchasing of our ingredients. We own the formula. You know, we do everything. So we're almost like renting their facility. It depends on their capabilities and how deep they can and want to go. And then, you know, that there's two challenges in that world. Is one is the product development. You know, you gotta get expertise to help you with that. And then, you know, the buying of the ingredients and the packaging, and the cost is just enormous. You know, I mean, you know, how much you have to, just your glass and your packaging and your labeling and your cork and your shipper, you know, and then that's not even getting to the liquid.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Understanding your costs, understanding your fully loaded costs, you know, you need to know that before you get to the pricing of it. So, how do you just work with different people on these ventures, you know, like different founders, different teams, you know, like I, mm-hmm. we're here at Accountfully, you know, I have my team, but I have clients, but at the same time, like you're basically running four businesses here with your marketing venture and, mm-hmm. you know, the three businesses that are together, they're inventory based, these brands we're talking about, like, you know, finding partners that you can work with, but at the same time, this founder here may have a different mindset than this founder over here. So like, how did those challenges work together? You know, and this is normal for a small business with various partners anyways, but how do you kind of work through those aspects?
Yeah. I mean, the good news is the challenge is the same, and you can use what you're using in one business for the other business. And, you know, there is best practice and there's tools. And there's also talent. So, I mean, not only do I work with you guys across all three businesses, but I work with others across all three businesses, where and when it's relevant. Or, you know, modeling to me is a really important skill set in innovation. Financial modeling, supply chain modeling, modeling your sales versus actuals. I mean, all those tools are really important. And you know, there's an art and a science to them. The better they are, the better you are. I, you know, have gotten better and better at modeling, and I use them across all three. And you know, every single business is going to have a different situation in their model. So you may learn something in one business and you say, oh, I'm going to use that on these, you know, and now, you know, that's how you get better. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. 100% makes sense. From a modeling perspective, like what is your workflow for modeling? Like every month, every quarter, you know, do you update it or do you review it? You know, do you have any best practices of just, you know, the model that, you know, process that you use?
Sure. Yeah. So it's an animal. I start out, you know, pretty bare, get a lot of tabs. I mean, I walk through the P&L. Every line item is a tab, or they can end up becoming their own model, like working capital, supply chain. I do monthly, 5-year monthly, and then it breaks down to an annual, but I just have to. And then, you know, I walk through the P&L, and then I continue on to working capital, and then what's the capital requirement, all the way to outcome analysis. You know, what's the return on investment? What's the Series A, Series B, Series C? And I build that, and I'm always using it. We'll use that for the operating plan for the year. You know, give it to you guys so we can compare actual to plan. But I tend to update it quarterly in some regard for the operating plan, and then annually for sure.
Love it. It's interesting, the models. You can have templates, but the next thing you know, there's 65 more tabs on Excel sheet or five, you know,
totally.
Just like, I need a tab for this. So it's always, they're very individualized. And that's kind of, you know, for our clients that have a model, I'm like, you know, don't just pay somebody to have a model and then just to raise money and don't use it. You need to understand the inner workings of it. You need to update it consistently, whether it's monthly or quarterly, you need to assess against it. And you can literally use it as a tool to forecast scenarios, to your point, like, when will I run out of money? You know, when do I need money? Whether, and what is the amount of money I can get? And then that saves the day in terms of just being proactive of like, maybe I can get a cash flow loan for 100 to 150K to bridge these 2 months versus other scenarios that you have to give equity on. So it's all about that scenario planning and analysis. Initially, when you talked about, you know, raising money is the hardest thing as a brand owner, you know, with these brands that you're having here that you're supporting, you know, Hercules Mulligan went through the crowdfunding equity route or is currently going through that. So, you know, how was that decision made? How has that process been? Just kind of give us a little more like thought, you know, or walkthrough of that.
Sure. Yeah, that was an interesting one. So it's definitely related to the brand and our situation. I don't recommend to go into crowdfunding unless you really think it through and understand it, and also get some expertise. And we're fortunate. One of the people on our team really is very capable in that area. So, I mean, first off, you know, we launched direct to consumer within the Flaviar community, and you know, the brand did great. I mean, it was a hit. You know, quickly sold 2,000 cases, and the next thing you know, we're at 2,000 bottles. Next thing you know, we're at 15,000 bottles, 12,000 consumers, and then, you know, we're getting to fundraising and we're raising money from angels. And we said, well, why don't we go back to these consumers and ask them if they're interested? And you know, we did. We didn't ask them for money. We just asked them if they were interested. And the reaction was very positive. So we decided to launch a crowdfunding campaign, you know, did a lot of analysis of who we use. We used Start Engine. And then we spent 4 months trying to figure out how to do a campaign. And that's where, you know, this individual Yaka and our team did an amazing job. I mean, I can't even take much credit for it, because the Flaviar team did just such an amazing job here. And, you know, I think we put probably, you know, a best in class campaign together. And, you know, our raise was 750 grand, which we thought was going to take 3 to 6 months. At least that's what Start Engine told us. And, you know, we're oversubscribed after 3 weeks. In fact, right now we have a waiting list. You know, we would have kept going, but we just don't need the money. So, you know, because we also at the same time got angel investors within the rest. So it was an amazing experience. The key to it, I will tell you, Brad, is we had 12,000 emails and that we could go out, that people consumed our brand and we were already beloved, you know. And if we didn't have that, you know, we would have to go find it. We'd have to do paid media or something. We'd have to get a list.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's leveraging your network, your connections, your brand loyalty, numbers, et cetera, is really key if you're going to go that route. It's, again, it's just crazy the different routes you can go to these days with getting money, whether it's debt, loan, short-term loans, whether it's crowdfunding equity, whether it's the traditional angel investing, friends and family, you know, and then you get to the end of SBA loan, you know, it spans the entire spectrum now, and it's never been easier to get money. But you've got to be careful in terms of where your money is, what the terms are, what you're giving away, and all that stuff, which is key for founders. So
what's exciting about this is now we have 800 I know you have Mark Levitt on your channel, and Mark calls them investors. Your crowdfunding people are investors, and you know, obviously they're consumers, they're investors, but they're now brand advocates and ambassadors. And you know, what more could you ask for?
Yeah. I know a lot of people in the world don't, you know, want to be an entrepreneur or be a investor. They see all these cool things like, oh yeah, if you got in on Amazon or things early, well, now these people are actually, they're, you know, hey, I have Acme as a brand, this is my company, or I'm an owner of this company. And it's interesting, the mindset of just normal people out there. And then when they do that, then all of a sudden they buy it, or they buy it for their friends for holidays or birthdays. And it's just this kind of, this very cool kind of brand investor brand, you know, loyalty person that's just there to support you. So it's super cool in terms of that type of relationship. So I'm glad that that's went well. So outside of that, you know, as we kind of are nearing towards the end of this, you know, from a sales marketing perspective, that's your brand. Like, how do you assess, what are some of your key metrics related to sales in terms of, you know, top line profitability of sales, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing is, you know, on the actual operational front, we look at, you know, what's our account sold? How many accounts are we in? What's the repeat order in those accounts? Really important. What's the quality of that repeat order? What's the conditions in that account? Certainly pricing is important. How much discounting do we have to do, if any? And, you know, if we are just doing discounting, hopefully it's based on volume buy. It's a bracket price discount, not just, you know, a pay to play. And then, you know, what's the quality in terms of on-premise and off-premise relative to our business. And, you know, we always say in the on-premise, you build the brand, in the off-premise, you build the business. And that's where you really can scale, is in the off-premise. Very expensive in the on-premise to do business. So we do look at splitting out our sales that way. And, you know, right now, you know, we're a small brand. We're not meaningful to a distributor. So we have to put our own sales team, our reps, on the street, which is, you know, a big cost for us. So, you know, the measuring of the deal flow and the sales pipeline for each other sales rep is a complicated area. You know, right now we actually do it via Google Sheets. We're going to move to an online CRM tool. We're going to use one called Lilypad. You know, in the beverage alcohol industry, where you have a three-tier system and a distributor, it's a little more complicated than when you're, you know, when you're direct to consumering with Amazon and can see everything.
So true. So true. My, background originally in small business was, when I was working at a big accounting firm, I went to become kind of a first accountant controller for a family of wine businesses. And they were set up in that manner to, one's a wholesaler, one's a supplier, one's the broker, one's, and I'm like, what is going on here? Like, and that's where you learn the old, the three-tier system and the different requirements of each state. It's a completely different animal. But they have people and partners that you can partner with to help the compliance needs of all that. So, so anyways, kind of wrapping up here, you know, kind of, the final kind of two questions we have for you, Steve, and then we'll chat more about your brands afterwards. Tell us one CPG industry do.
You know, I think the most important thing is you got to get your concept right. You know, in VC speak, you always talk about risk, and there's three types of risk. You got concept risk, you got execution risk, and you got financing risk. And I always believe the concept risk is the critical one. If the more you can go to town and get your concept right, you know, your packaging, your product, everything that relative to your proposition, execution, it will take care of itself. You'll attract the talent, and you'll attract the money, and you'll figure it out. But, you know, I call tortoise and bolt, because I think, you know, you gotta think slow and act fast. And the part you got to think slow on is on that concept. You got to really know. The brand name is critical. You know, what is your differentiating? What's your point of difference? You know, is your product good? It's got to be amazing to succeed. So, I mean, that's the do. I mean, that to me is huge.
Yeah, definitely tell where you come from in the sales and marketing and brand development world. All right, what is one CPG industry don't?
Don't get over your skis. You know, don't fall in love with your product. Make sure you are, you know, certainly you can be passionate and you can internalize it, but you got to separate yourself from your product. And as a founder, you can't get too attached to it. You have to look at it objectively. That's why it's important to have, you know, people like yourself telling you, you know, another point of view, and just don't get over your skis. You know, go listen to your consumer. And you know, keep in mind, people are going to tell you what you want to hear. So try and find out what you don't want to hear, and just don't get over your skis too far. You know, especially when it comes to expansion. You know, start small, prove concept, and then expand. Don't try and rule the world. You know, we're not on Shark Tank. You know, it's not as sexy and as fun as you think it is, especially when you fail. So, you know, just be an adult about it and don't get over your skis. Really just try and go through it sequentially. If you do, you'll that's how the guy, you know, the big successes work. I mean, I always look at Tito's and it's a 30-year overnight success, you know.
Yep.
But what a success.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that that information. So good stuff. All right, Steve, really enjoyed the chat. So where can people go always find these products?
Yeah, so Hercules Mulligan, you can buy us online. All three products you can buy online. Hercules Mulligan, go to HerculesMulliganCompany.com. American Vodka, you can buy at literally www.AmericanVodka.com. And Bahnbrecher is at Bahnbrecher.com, Bahnbrecker. So go online and you can get delivery right to wherever you live.
Love it. AmericanVodka.com was available, huh?
Yeah, we got it. Like we had to pay for the URL. But I'll tell you, it's worth it.
Yeah. I think simple brands like that speak to a big chunk of society these days, which is awesome. You know, it's like simplicity in the brand name. That's, I think, what it comes down to when you're saying killing the brand or getting that brand concept right. It's like making it not too complicated, but simplistic, but very sophisticated. You know what I'm saying? You're like, wow,
that's right. Cool.
So awesome. Yep. All right. Steve Lutman, episode 18, month end podcast. Steve, thanks so much for your time. Again,
thank he's you,
the director of Torx and Bolt Marketing Adventures, and you can find him anywhere with these three brands. So Steve, thanks again. And really enjoyed the chat.
Thanks, Brad. Likewise. Take care.